Hello and welcome. You are tuned in to another episode of Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. I'm your host, Tony Doman, and here on this program, each and every week, I find and feature different themes relating to Appalachian culture and then play songs and feature tales and stories all about our topic of choice. And today I've got a great show lined up for you. Today I'm joined by Kieran Singsary, who is the president of the International Storytelling Center. I'll be airing a wonderful and insightful interview with Kieran about a variety of topics, from what they've been up to over at the International Storytelling Center in the wake of COVID, which is over in Jonesboro, Tennessee, like the Freedom Stories Projects and so much more. I'm just so excited to bring you today's program. We're going to get into that interview here in just a few minutes, so please stick around and stay tuned. You are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol.
About the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, I've been smiling lately, dreaming about the world at one, and I believe it could be someday it's going to come. 'Cause out on the edge of darkness, there rides a peace train. Oh, peace train, take this country. Come take me home again. Yeah, I've been smiling lately, thinking about the good things to come, and I believe it could be something good has begun. Oh, peace train sounding louder.
Ride on the peace train.
Kat Stevens there with Peace Train to kick off this hour of Mountain Song and Story. Our special guest today is Kiran Singsari, who is president of the International Storytelling Center, who Kiran is also a very strong advocate for peace building. So we had to kick off this hour of the show with a peace-centered song. I love that song, Peace Train, there by Kat Stevens. And a little bit about Kiran. He's been a guest on this program before, but we definitely wanted to talk and check in recently and see what they've been up to over at the International Storytelling Center. And a little bit about Kiran. Before his current role at the International Storytelling Center, he developed a number of award-winning arts, culture, and human rights programs in cultural centers across the UK and Ireland. He uses storytelling as a tool for building social empathy and intercultural understanding. And Kiran has spoken and led programming at the Library of Congress, the Kennedy Center, the U.S. Senate of Foreign Relations, the U.S. State Department, and he really champions his belief in the power of human creativity, arts, storytelling, and social justice through his advocacy role to the UNESCO Scotland and through his service as a Rotary Peace Fellow. Kiran firmly believes storytelling not only has the power to enrich lives, but it also holds the key to building a conflict-free society. It is always so great to be able to sit down and speak with Kiran. So let's get on into our interview for the day. All right, Kiran, so let's just start our conversation by giving our listeners a brief update on what's been happening over at the International Storytelling Center. Obviously, of course, COVID has affected every aspect of everybody's life. What kind of programming have you all adapted to fit into this digital world right now and just this virtual space we're all living in?
Okay, so first of all, the question's going to be challenging because you said brief. You said that's a storyteller, and that's not possible. Brief is not possible in storytelling. I can't do that in brief. So. But I could try. I try.
Okay. You don't have to be brief. I don't know why I said that.
I don't know why brief. Yeah, I don't know. It's okay. No, it's okay. I just, I don't know. It's been an interesting, year, but it's actually been really, in many, many, many ways, there's like the yin and yang. It's good. There's lots of really good stuff. There's been a, you know, like, I don't know, that word for crisis in Mandarin means both danger and opportunity. So there's been danger, but there's been incredible opportunities to kind of, really expand and explore and develop new programming and really reach global audiences. So I'd say that, like, when the pandemic kind of really hit us and there was a lockdown, you know, we all started to kind of really innovate and explore new ways. But the wonderful thing about storytelling is that it's universal. It can transcend media. You know what I mean? You can reach audiences in ways that still are intimate and exploratory and do incredible interactive stuff. So we started to really do a lot of that thinking and programming early on in March. Obviously we had the big flagship we had to prepare for, which is the National Storytelling Festival, which is on our minds and everyone's minds, which is the same, you know, in the same sense, like Bristol Rhythm and Roots have to think about the same type of thing. It's a big operation and it doesn't happen overnight. You know, it takes months and months of planning and money and budget and investment. But anyway, going back to, so last year we were able to kind of really pivot a lot of work to do training. Initially in March, April, forgot what month comes after March.
I'm not yeah. I don't know what year it is.
I don't give you some logic. I'm logical. But yeah, we reached out to our healthcare partners, Ballard Health, and said, what do you need? How can we help? And we started to do this really interesting storytelling interaction work and providing footage from our festival for patients, which put them out of their comfort. And that really went really well. And then, you know, they gave me a scenario of five scenarios, things that they're dealing with, tension, you know, kind of fear of the unknown, doing a job that they haven't done. Often many nurse practitioners haven't done before. So we devised a storytelling training and kind of come a lot from my background in sort of peace building and conflict resolution work, and applied that to storytelling in a way that could build a digital training program to enable healthcare workers, care workers, caregivers, to be able to use stories in a way to build resilience, recovery, comfort, a sense of camaraderie with their peers, essentially to build strength in a way that could help them do their jobs. And we piloted that in a Franklin Wood Hospital in a digital media. We did it all through smartphones. And then it kind of, we measured it. We brought in some specialists to kind of look at the impact and to survey and collect the data. And we expanded it. It was a very rapid program. And then we ended up doing a much more extended version. And that ended up being a program we now call Stories as Medicine. And it's trained around 300 healthcare workers in our region, across different parts of the country, and also in Australia. Surprising, we did with a project in Australia as well. So we've been able to kind of do this digital training work, and that's now become an integrated part of our work, looking at storytelling as medicine, as healing, recovery, and for resilience. So that's been one of the success programs. But I'd say, there's been a lot of other core work, thinking about live programming. So much what we're known about is live events and concerts and storytelling concerts, both storytellers and musicians. So we were fortunate to be able to, really reach out to supporters and funders, to receive a couple of CARES Act grants as well from the NEA and the NEH, our state supporters as well, Humanities Tennessee and Tennessee Arts Commission, South Arts, and use that money to develop, quality-based camera and digital platform. It's not a Zoom, it was a designed platform specifically for storytelling, for quality-based experiences. For about 40 artists around the nation, we sent camera equipment so they could record live footage in their room from David Hole and Josh Goforth in Asheville. It was a living room concert, and it was an intimate concert.
Wow,
it was really wonderful. We had Sheila K. Adams actually came to Jonesboro. We did a kind of a concert in a way that allowed Sheila to tell stories about her heritage through music and song in a way that I've never experienced or listened to before. It was really beautiful to see that intimacy and that kind of that unveiling of her, almost like vulnerability, this the exploration of what it means to come to this place and what these stories mean to her, connecting back to, generations of traditions passed through, these mountains and through her family. And so we were able to put that into a format of, a national storytelling festival, and which reached just as many attendees as our event that we have in October. But what happened was it expanded to different countries around the world, 12 countries around the world, all 50 states apart from South Dakota. And I said, if I ever run for president, our campaign starts in South Dakota. Like, I don't know why we're in South Dakota, but all 50 states apart from South Dakota. So I don't know why. What's happening there?
That's strange. Yeah, we need to reach out to South Dakota.
Yeah, I know. Campaign, South Dakota.
Yeah.
It was just an incredible, and it was just a beautiful, well-curated, artistic platform that allowed for people to give intimacy and connection. One visitor that comes to Jonesboro every year said that he was donating his ticket because he said, we brought a community together after 9/11 through storytelling, and we're going to do it again. He believed we're going to do it again. And, I think a lot of it really paid off, that kind of loyalty to an art form and belief in it really, really came through, But everything from, like, there was one family, I think it was up in Maine or somewhere, I'm not sure exactly where, but another state, and they had set up a little tent in their backyard. They live streamed the festival from a big TV screen, and they got all their grandkids, and they replicated the festival. They even made sandwiches that they would get at Main Street Cafe. And they sent us all these images and stories. The story that came out of that was just phenomenal.
Wow, that's amazing. I love to hear that. I love that y'all, like so many arts and culture organizations and centers, have really, we've been forced to adapt and really forced to explore this digital space. That project where you all have actually provided the equipment for storytellers to record with and make that a really high quality thing is fantastic. I think that's what a lot of musicians and performers deal with, is sometimes, you can do a lot with just your cell phone. That's really interesting and great.
Yeah. We hired a local videographer it's almost like we curated this into a production that, you know, it was a very unique type of production. It's kind of almost like a TED talk with a podcast, with a kind of a high quality production, interactive. So it worked really well, you know, and it was well thought. Luckily in our end, we had some months to plan for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the pandemic really kind of hit everybody, you know, in early part of the year, you know, we had a little bit of planning time. We had some thinking. We had a chance to think through that process to make it the best thing that we could possibly do. And it's now allowed us to think about hybrid programs, recording the actual event so that we can continue that work throughout the year. You know, I think many of the challenges that all of us have in East Tennessee is our weather, right? You know, we can't host events as well in terms of bringing national, international visitors in January or December or February, because you pay for an artist to come from North Carolina, and you know you have to honor that contract, but you you're constantly relying on, with the weather coming, will it snow? But when you do, it means you can still do these big events like our festivals that are really important for our region, but you can also continue that relationship year round. And most importantly, pay the artists. Make sure artists get paid for the work that they do. Because it's essential. The work that artists are doing is, none of us were going to get through if we can't listen to music or stories or performing arts. And you know what I mean? This is the thing that allows us to, you know, bring us together, but also give us hope for what's beyond the moment.
Absolutely. I'm glad you bring that point up. Paying artists is so important. So important. I'm really interested about the Freedom Stories project. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know you all have different themes and things going on. Just last week, I think you had your first the first one via Zoom, I believe.
First one for 2021.
Gotcha. Okay.
So yeah, thanks. So I like to talk about freedom. It's a good topic.
Let's do it. Let's talk about freedom.
Let's talk about freedom.
Yes.
But you bring it out of me. You bring me. You make me go giggly. Okay.
I'm glad.
So Freedom Stories was a program that we got funding for from the National Endowment for Humanities, our nation's leading agency for the humanities. But it was a program that we felt was very important. I mean, because it's about exploring Black heritage in Appalachia. When we think of Appalachia, you know, before I came here, I didn't really associate, you know, Black heritage with Appalachia. You know, I watched TV programs as a kid growing up in South England, the Beverly Hillbillies. You know what I mean? I didn't know Alex Haley was from East Tennessee. I didn't know, you know, Nikki Giovanni was from our region. I didn't know these people. And so it was, and I heard about the Underground Railroad, but I didn't know it was so connected to our region. And so the idea of the program was really connecting what's unique about our region from a traditions, a historical perspective, in a way that can explore the contributions of Black culture, history, tradition. What can we learn from that? And how has it shaped a unique American tradition? African-American storytelling is unique to America, and it's an American tradition, and Appalachia has shaped that, you know? And so, you know, if you think about the founder, the Mama Linda Goss from Alcoa, Tennessee, and she's an elder, she now lives in Baltimore, but she always talks about Appalachia. It's my home. You know what I mean? It's a home place. And that's where, so the idea of Freedom Stories came about in this program, and we managed to even recruit, hire a scholar, Dr. Alastine Turley, who is a daughter of black coal miners from Eastern Kentucky. No, wait, Northeast. Yeah, Eastern Kentucky, Harlan, Kentucky. She's an African-American studies scholar, and she's just phenomenal. And so we hired her, but she also, because of the pandemic, she had to work from Kentucky. But we curated this event, and in the summer, after the death of George Floyd, we were really, we had the program where we were devising for the summer, and we were like, well, we can't do it in person. There's a national conversation going. The importance of the humanities means it provides a safe space for important discussion and help us essentially talk about what's so important, who we are, our society, our values, our beliefs, our humanity. Essentially, what's the humanities front, the humanities, right? And so we thought, well, we didn't just want to put a statement about why, you know, about what was happening. We decided, well, let's talk about freedom. Let's do an event when the nation's celebrating it, July the 3rd. We didn't do it on July the 4th, we could have, but we thought we'd do it July the 3rd, just at the same time. And it was 3 weeks after the death of George Floyd. And we brought, you know, from Appalachian scholars to young Black Lives Matter activists to storytellers. And it was a place in which to kind of really unpack the movement of Black Lives Matter, but really looking at what does that mean? You know, what does it mean to our region, our history, our connection to place? And that reached, we had no idea, no marketing. We didn't put any mark. We just put it on Facebook. We did a Zoom to Facebook Live event. 302,000 people it reached.
Wow, that's America, amazing.
Czech Republic, Nigeria, Australia. And we had no idea that would be, you know, it would reach so many people. And the aspect of what we did is that, but the great thing is that people really appreciated the opportunity to learn, to find out about something that's being talked about. But what does it mean? You know, what does it mean to different people? You know, we live side by side, and I think the vast majority of people are curious. We don't hate each other. We have shared stories that connect us. So let's find out about one another. And that's what people wanted to do. And we're proud of the fact that, you know, whatever we do, we bring together everyone from all political spectrums. And I think the vast majority of people want to learn about, they want to learn about each other, how you see the world. Do you mean? And I think that's really important. And so the program has had 7 sessions since. We've looked at Melungeon history, again, unique to Appalachia.
Yeah. Right?
And this is about exploring a region that's always been a tri-racial region, you know. And we've looked at the Underground Railroad, slavery in Appalachia. We've brought, you know, Robert Jones, who's a blues instrumentalist, who featured in our national festival. And to last week, which was interestingly, we had a session, it was moving to from slavery, abolition, to post-Reconstruction to civil rights. So we're moving to more about dialogue events. But last week we had an event on looking at Appalachia and Jim Crow, which really unpacked the legacies of Jim Crow. What does it mean? Part of that discussion helped to discuss in a safe way some context of what took place in the capital on January the 6th. You know, when do people get a chance to really unpack that in a thoughtful way, in a dialogue way, and to explore it? And that's the nature of that program. I'd say since we launched that program in July, over 800,000 people it's reached. We've had actual around 10 or 11,000 actual attendees. And the aspect of it, we're also doing a social impact survey for all the people that haven't come to our region, and, you know, all the attendees online, 52% of people said they're now inspired to visit our region and learn about our culture. Now, imagine that. So, it's, you know, these people all over the world saying they want to now come to our region and unpack it and explore it, I mean, and visit our space. And, you know, I think that's really important. So the program will continue until the summer, and the next event will be on February the 13th. It's free. entirely free, that program as well. And you just go to our Facebook page, and I think the next one's going to explore sort of civil rights, the civil rights movement. But again, it's about storytelling and scholarship and discussion. So it's bringing it all together.
But yeah, the reach to that program is just truly incredible. I'm just floored and amazed by that, and totally, totally proud to be living in this region and know that so many people want to learn more about it and are coming here. And what you all do is just fantastic. I'm a huge admirer. I actually got to go to the festival in 2019. So it was amazing.
I saw it.
I love it. It was fantastic. I never really experienced a storytelling festival like that. Or at all, really. I really value what you all do. And I'm wondering a little bit about some of your regional partnerships. I'm sure that what you all are doing is really influencing some other local, you know, how does that work, especially in the time of COVID and sharing ideas and crossing barriers and just connecting while we're all so distant? I know these are all questions that we hear all the time now, words like distant and 6 feet apart and COVID, but it is really interesting to see how we're working, the arts and culture especially, is still working together in this really, this time that we're just living in.
Yeah, and I think it's important for people to know that, like, for example, you know, what Bristol Rhythm and Roots does, what the National Storytelling Festival does, they're big flagship events, right? And they bring people to our region. But they also help us. We're all nonprofits. What do we do with that money, the income? We pump it back into our region. So, for example, you know, the what we're able to produce and do year round, which, you know, may not be on the news, it may not be in all the month, but we're able to do programs to work with youth at risk in our region. You know, we developed a program called Shiro's Journey, which predominantly works with young girls at risk, age 10 to 13. And empowers them if they were from maybe vulnerable to whatever it might be, isolation, low self-esteem, even opioid or the epidemics, you know, poverty. And we work really closely with them to develop their skill set so they can learn how to use storytelling to build self-esteem, confidence, public speaking. And that's the impact of some of the work. So we put that, and that's local, that's regional work. We train teachers. We do a free teacher training for teachers across East Tennessee. Right? We also have a program called Youth Appalachian Summit, which is for young Appalachians between the ages of 18 and 25. Again, it's free. But young Appalachians that are, and one part of that reason is to really encourage, you know, young Appalachians that maybe are here in our region, whether they are from graduates, from local colleges, or from low-income communities, to have an opportunity for free to come and learn skill sets, how to envision the story of their home place, and learn how to build community. And that's a training program that we provide so that young Appalachians don't feel they have to go to New York or DC or Asheville. They can stay in East Tennessee and stay here, you know, harness this region, contribute to it, and make this place home. You don't have to go elsewhere to experience it. You can harness it in your home place. And the idea is about cultivating a sense of pride. And so that's a program that you know, we do, but we had to put that part on hold because we really value doing that in person. And the plan is to do that this year in 2021. There's another project we got called I Have a Story. And this is particularly about enabling young people in neighborhoods. This is for Washington County specifically, but in neighborhoods that may be historically disadvantaged or low income, and getting kids to kind of really explore and unpack the history of those neighborhoods and develop a way to tell its story, to build that sense of pride that where I live has beauty, where I live is worth celebrating. And so the idea is to really harness and work with kids to become young storytellers. So there's lots of that type of project. We do an incredible, I think it's, I'm a bit biased, but a really cool program with Unicoi County Hospital. And we're working with Unicoi County Hospital to become the nation's first storytelling designated hospital. And we are working with them. You know, Unicoi County is next to us. We, you know, it's probably one of the most beautiful places on earth. I go camping there whenever I can. There's natural beauty is astounding. We know that, but it has high health disparity too. So the hospital is a kind of a program where we're training, you know, from administrators to, you know, hospital staff, as well as bringing traditional artists to perform on the peripheral of the hospital grounds, that fosters a kind of connection between the local community and the hospital. The idea of hospital being a performing space. You know, we think of that art is not just something you experience in a theater or a museum. It can be experienced in the places that are important to our everyday life. A hospital is the beginning, middle, and end for so many of us. Why can't it be integrated into the creativity of everyday life? So it's a story. So art should be experienced in everyday settings. And that project will make sure that Unicoi County Hospitals achieves a first of a kind program to give it a storytelling designation, so we can celebrate even the health culture of our region, if that makes sense.
Sitting on the front porch on a summer afternoon, in a straight back chair on two legs, leaned against the wall. Watch the kids playing with June bugs on a string, and chase the glowing fireflies when evening shadows fall. In my Tennessee mountain home, life is as peaceful as a baby's sigh. In my Tennessee mountain home, crickets sing in the fields nearby. Honeysuckle vine clings to the fence along the lane. Their fragrance makes the summer wind so sweet. And on a distant hilltop, an eagle spreads its wings, and a songbird on a fence post sings a melody. You love just laughing, talking, making future plans. And when the folks ain't looking, you might steal a kiss or two, sitting in the porch swing holding hands. In my Tennessee mountain home, life is as peaceful as a baby.
Dolly Parton there with My Tennessee Mountain Home. If you are just tuning in, you are listening to Mountain Song and Story right here on Radio Bristol. And we have been airing an interview here on the show today with Kiran Singh Sarah, who is president of the International Storytelling Center. We're going to go ahead and get on into the second part of that interview right now.
We do have a proposal in right now, which is, I don't know if I want to jinx it, but I might just put it out there anyway. But we work with 10 community partners from Ballard Health, Public Health, ETSU Public Health, Appalachian RC&D Council, Mountain City, which is one of my, I love Mountain City so much, and Johnson County. And the idea is to work in 8 counties of Northeast Tennessee over a 2-year period and establish a health, tourism, arts, traditional arts, culture, agriculture, and train people to tell their own stories in a way can develop the first storytelling heritage trail for East Tennessee, similar to the Crooked Road for Virginia, similar to the Bourbon Trail for Eastern Kentucky, or the heritage trails of Western North Carolina. Why aren't we doing that in East Tennessee? This is the region that can celebrate storytelling. And it should be told by people that live and work and play and make this place home over many generations. And so that's a program about harnessing our own. And obviously the idea is that when visitors come to experience the National Storytelling Festival, Rhythm and Roots, let's encourage them to stay 2 more weeks and visit the entire region and you know, celebrate our culture.
I love that. And I wish you all, I hope that that gets funded and you all can do that, because that is definitely needed in this area. And I love the idea and the goal of just equipping people with the tools that they need to record histories, to record those stories, because and educating people. And I think that that's fantastic. So good luck with that. I really hope that that pulls through. I would love to see that like ASAP, like tomorrow. I want to see it.
It's with the Appalachian Regional Commission right now, so we'll see how it spans out, but we'll find out in 2021. I'm hopeful.
Yeah. So maybe talk a little bit about, I know you have a lot of your history and experiences in peace building and community and peace building, and maybe talk a little bit about how that is relating to the current world, what we're living through right now.
Thanks. I am trained in peace building. That's my background. And I was always an artist. You know, back in Scotland, when I lived in Glasgow, you know, I set up a program that used the art forms of storytelling and other art forms, ballad and traditional song and traditional heritage and culture, to unpack what it means to be live in a place. And I worked a lot with communities in Northern Ireland, Catholic and Protestant, nationalist and loyalist, and even paramilitary groups, politicians and gangs. And the idea was to unpack, what does it mean? Where's our shared connections? And, you know, for example, an example in Northern Ireland, when we would unpack, well, here's a community that maybe went through a 30-year war. People lived side by side, but didn't realize they shared so much traditional culture together. A song, Green Fields of France, is a song that's sung in both communities, but it's a time when the country was united, was fighting in the Great War. So you find these songs, like when you go to a festival and you hear a song from, you know, the Civil War, well, that's something that it's part of our national heritage. You know, I mean, these are, or songs from, you know, the abolition movements, or the idea is to kind of, It's a way to which you kind of like, I don't know, almost like really help people find meaning in their heart. And that's where peace building really is the most effective. It's not a policy. It's not a rapport. It's not a think, you know, a white paper. It's a movement that resides in our hearts. Peace can only happen when we're all engaged and we feel included, when it's meaningful for me and my family. The universality of art forms, what it does, it taps into the universal emotions of love, connection, family, joy, the desire to be loved, the desire to love, to feel a sense of belonging and be with one another in a community. These are the things that we defend, and these are the things that we fight for, and these are the things that we should celebrate. And art is the way to unpack that and understand that. And so when I got the opportunity, and I came to the United States on a peace scholarship program, you know, UNC Chapel Hill, I got the opportunity to focus on folklore and storytelling as the means to which I believe is the most powerful force to achieve peaceful society. because it belongs to everyone. We all are storytellers inside of us, at the potential to be. And so when I graduated from UNC, they offered me, I applied for the job at, the National Storytelling Center, and then they just offered it me. I go for my interview. I talked about, storytelling as this force. It's a grounding force. It's a place that storytelling teaches us to listen, but listening leads to understanding, and understanding leads to connection. That's the foundation for peace building. Whether it's between two people or two nations or two groups, you cannot have peace unless you have empathy and understanding for different people's experiences. Unfortunately, that's why it's sacred when we do it in person, in community. A porch storytelling is sacred. It's a peace movement because it's about really listening to one another, not what we've been told to hear about the other, but to really listen to one another. And so, we layer that into our work, but it already existed. The whole peace building community understand the value and the power of it. It's why one of our sponsors is the Alliance for Peace Building, the world's largest alliance for peace building, over 100 organizations working in 180 countries. And part of that work means, I can say that what we try to do beyond just in our region is we do facilitation work as well. And we facilitated everything from connections in South Sudan, in India. We've worked with both administrations. In lead up to the 2016 election, when there was national riots and race tension, we helped the Faith and Neighborhood Partnership of the White House explore storytelling as a peace building tool to lower those tensions. We've done work during the administration with the Department of Defense to build storytelling curricula as an alternative to violent combat. We've brought young emerging leaders from Egypt, Lebanon, Turkey, and Iraq to Appalachia. Actually, it was in Cherokee, North Carolina, to understand, to build relationships with American traditions so that in the longer term, they can build connections with this cultural diplomacy work. And most recently, we even got to sit down with the staff of Marsha Blackburn, and then the same week, we got to work with the Biden-Harris administration transition team. I think politically maybe seen as very opposite, but there's a lot of things that are connected because we all care about heritage, culture, connection. The things that bind us that we all care about, and that's the role of storytelling. And so we're part of that initiative, and we're exploring a project to get connected more to truth and reconciliation as well. But one thing I would say is folk and traditional arts is a binding art form. Why? It's because you go to any festival, you will find people who are conservative, Democrat, all political spectrums appreciating bluegrass or appreciating country. We're appreciating blues because they're all linked, right? Or the stories, it's a binder. A festival is where do people get to meet and interact on a human level? It's not a conference, it's a festival. It's part of my life. And so that's why I feel that the festival is really much, the festival, the live events, the concerts, these are meaningful ways to really connect with people, one another. And that's where I feel it's not even a radical concept. It's just a thing that we've been doing for centuries. We try to harness the ability to be able to help others and train peace builders as well on that process, and train artists to become peace builders as well.
Yeah.
And, facilitate that type of dialogue. So that's important to me, important to our institution. And I think we can do it in inclusive ways as well.
Very insightful. I really appreciate you taking some time to talk about that. I think a lot of us forget that just what you just said, peace building is not something that it's something anybody can learn and anybody can apply in just your daily life. And I know that you, and I don't know a lot of people that have a lot of experience with it. You're probably the only person that I personally know that I could just drive down the road and talk to you about some tips on how to just make those kind of things happen. So,
Tony, I might challenge you a little bit on that. If that's okay.
I think
we're all peace builders. Everyone is. It's not just a few people. It's everyone's a peace builder. We do it all the time, every day. Peace, remember, starts at home. It starts in our relationship with our neighbors, with our family. It starts with ourselves. I mean, and when we pay it forward, when I go to Powell's and someone's bought my food, when I go to the counter, that's peace building. You know, when I smile at a stranger, when I connect with them, when I share something about my life, or I listen. Listening is a sacred act. It's an intentional act of love. And when you do that, you're saying, I value you, I care for you, you matter. When I listen to what you have to say, that's peace building. Do you see what I'm saying? It's not a policy. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be trained in it. It's very much about who we are as a people. It's part of our DNA, and we do it all the time. We just have to harness it and celebrate and remind ourselves what's important.
See, I'm learning so much. So insightful conversation. I love it. That's great. So I do have, we are kind of running slow on time. So I got running out of time. I do have a couple more questions I want to get to today. Talking about regional partners, one, I do, you all received the South Arts Resilience Grant, I do believe, correct? Yeah. Tell me a little bit about what resilience means to you all and you personally, especially, you know, the South Arts is a huge, fantastic organization supporting arts and culture in 9 states. And I saw that you all received that grant and was just so thrilled for you all. So yeah, talk a little bit about resilience.
Sure. Yeah. You know, resiliency, it sounds very, I tell you what it means for me, right? Resiliency for me, I grew up in the south of England, right? My family were refugees. My grandparents were labor migrants. They were farmers and carpenters, illiterate from the rural villages, farmlands of northern India. They had to leave there to find work, and they went to build the railroads in East Africa. And it was hard work. It was laboring work, right? They were hard working people, my grandparents. But they built a foundation. And when my parents married and had my older brother, they had 3 months to flee the country because of a dictatorship, and they came to Britain. They were robbed en route to the airport. They landed in a place when, unfortunately, there were neo-Nazis that kind of met with them at the airport. Plane had to divert, but they landed and they settled. They had nothing. My mother literally, they had, you know, everything was stolen from them, from the government and from robbers. But my mom stuffed the wedding jewelry into my brother's diaper and used that to lay the foundation for my family, early beginnings. And 4 years later, I was born. Now, when I was, you know, bullied in the playground and called the smelly immigrant or the curry boy, which, unfortunately, these kids are just kids. They're not bad. It's just sometimes that they're taught things, right? But it was, I felt very, you know, it wasn't nice, right? I felt really pushed out. Then I would go home, and my mother, she would tell me these stories on the door. I remember like standing there and crying. And my mother would remind me of where I came from. She would tell me stories of my grandparents, what they went through, stories of heritage, our warriorhood. We were rural people, but we took on the world's largest empire and we won. Be proud of where you come from. She told me stories about the travel, but she always told me about how my grandfather made a water well with his own hands so people in the scorching sun could drink fresh, clean water. Right? All these stories of survival and connection and heritage and tradition. And she said, now go back into the playground and tell them who you really are. And she wasn't saying go fight. She was saying, go tell them who you are. Do you know what I mean? And kind of like essentially this is who you are, make up, you know, this. And that was the foundation for me for really I have an identity, but I also have the tools to craft one too for myself as a British Asian? What does it mean living in a dual society, in a, you know, with different cultures? And building that sense of resilience was like, as a child, since we were kids, we've been falling down and we've been getting back up again. That's resilience. One of the things I like to think about when I came to Appalachia, it wasn't I was coming to a foreign place, I was coming home, right? Because when I came to Appalachia, you know, 7 years ago, I heard about this place, but this wasn't that. The traditions of what I'd learned from my family took me back to the villages and the rural villages and farmlands of northern India, because I understood that. And when I got to meet the children of Ray Hicks in Beech Mountain, North Carolina, the way they acted, the way they treated me was the same as the way that I understood one is supposed to be treated, right? When I also understood that resilience is not a tool, it's a value, especially for people in Appalachia. Because if you understand resiliency, it's survival. It's about understanding who you are. So it's about making sure that you are the person that tells your story rather than having somebody else tell your story for you, right? It's about, you know, overcoming the odds. And it's about building strength, recovery, connection. It's about the family gatherings that build our strength. It's about the connections to one another, all these things. And so a resiliency grants is thinking about why we got that resiliency grants, because essentially it's the mission of what we're about. It's what we do. If we can build a more resilient programming culture through our storytelling concerts, through our programming, all the things we do, we can support harnessing a more resilient region. So they gave us that grant that comes from South Arts, but via Andrew Mellon Foundation. And we're able to now just use that funding, put it into our work. And why can't, you know, every kid have the ability to, so when they think that they don't have worth, so you do have worth. Learn your stories, learn your culture, learn your traditions, and learn the value of who you are. Learn to love yourself. And that's the greatest form and force for resilience to overcome any obstacle, any challenge. You love yourself, you know where who you are, you can take on anything.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's incredible. I thank you so much. Yeah.
You're welcome.
You're always so inspiring and inspirational to talk to. I always enjoy our conversations.
I do as well.
Well, Karen, we are about running out of time here. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about where they can learn more about what you all are currently doing? Where can they find you online, and where can they find International Storytelling Center and you personally?
Well, I'm hiding.
If you're out, okay, that's all right. You're allowed to hide.
I'll be somewhere eating biscuits, probably. But the International Storytelling Center, just go to storytellingcenter.net, come to Jonesboro. We work across the region. But if you come to our Storytelling Center website, you can also find out about our online program, our concert series, which starts in mid-February, where there'll be a different storyteller every week. We're also doing workshops, training, all sorts of different types of program. You can come to one event, get a season pass, whatever you choose to do. Yeah, that's the best place. And if you're a child or a student or a teacher, or you're teaching your kid at home, one of the things I really want to encourage you to do, we have free story guides for grades 3 to 8, 100% free. You can get free footage from the festival, and you can also teach kids, your kids at home, if you're working. And if you have a cat, maybe you could apply it to a cat. I don't know. So maybe you could try it for the first time ever.
I could try, but, yeah. See, my kitty interrupted our interview earlier with his little squeaky toy. So I've got to go out there.
That's the new thing. We're going to brand it.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got lots of free resources. And if you're ever interested in just collecting your family story, your own, or collect, or, you know, it's a beautiful time to collect your stories from your grandparents or your parents. Understand who you are. We have free storytelling toolkits. Learn the techniques and tools to collect stories. And if kids can become story collectors, what a beautiful thing that is. You both honor your elders and your family, but you also learn how to become a storyteller yourself.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here with us today, Kieran. I can't wait for till our next conversation. You take care.
You too, Tony. Thanks so much.
All right, folks, thank you so much for tuning in. You have been listening to an interview with Kieran from the International Storytelling Center here on Mountain Song and Story today. Some really great, thought-provoking, insightful, and informative and inspiring stuff today here on the show. Remember, you can catch this program, Mountain Song and Story, every Thursday at 4 o'clock right here each and every week on Radio Bristol. You can also check out past shows if you visit the Mountain Song and Story program blog page over at listenradiobristol.org. As always, I've got all of the songs, materials, and resources from today's show over there, so go check it out, listenradiobristol.org. Special thanks again to Kieran over there at the International Storytelling Center, and please go check out the blog post again. We'll have links to where you can learn more about what they are doing. I'm going to leave you today with one more song, another great inspiring one to end on, Imagine by John Lennon. Thanks again, and I'll catch you next week.
Imagine there's no heaven. See if you try. No hell below us. Above us, only sky. Imagine no possessions.